Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Who needs a reading right when you can dance and sing? La 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 la. Forget about your algebra and calculus. You can always do your homework on the morning bus. Can't tell a verb from a noun. They're the nicest kids in town.
Broadway and money and the lack thereof. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up on the show, we'll find out how much the arts are worth to the city. And classical music and hip-hop collide in our studio. But first, we all know that the city's vibrant music, fashion, and art sectors make New York a great place to live, and they generate a lot of money from tourist dollars. So what happens when a strike brings most of Broadway, including this musical, Hairspray, to a grinding halt, as it did last Saturday? Well, we're joined on the phone by Robert J. Hughes, staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Robert, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
How much money is New York City losing each day through this Broadway strike?
Well, the estimate is about $17 million to various businesses, including theater and related industries.
What would those related industries include?
Oh, that would include restaurants, hotels, cabs, babysitting even, and also just the theater industry itself, the cost of doing business in the theater, which the industry is responsible for about 45,000 jobs all told.
But now, you know, there are still tourists who are here, and maybe they came here intending to see Jersey Boys or Mamma Mia or The Lion King, but they're going elsewhere instead. So wouldn't that money still be going into the city economy somehow?
In some ways it will, but many of these people have gotten refunds on their tickets. And so instead of maybe hanging around the theater district where most of these shows are, they will go and do other tourist things around the country, around the city, including, say, the Hershey store or go down to the Staten Island Ferry or something. But in many other cases, they might not even come to the city.
So, and of course, people in the city who, for whom a Broadway show is a subway ride away, then whatever they were going to spend that evening, I guess, is not being spent.
Yes. In fact, restaurants they might have chosen to go to before the show, they're not going to go to. They've canceled reservations.
Now, can you give us an update on the situation? What's happening with scheduled talks?
Well, talks haven't been held since before the strike, but now there will be talks this weekend with the hope that something can be negotiated, perhaps ideally before Thanksgiving, because that's when the big holiday season begins here.
So that $17 million a day figure that you quoted us just a moment ago, that doesn't really give us the full impact of what a long-term strike could mean once we hit the holidays.
No. I mean, this is a kind of figure that they use the Broadway League to amortize over the year. Broadway contributes about $5 billion a year to the city through ticket sales, visitor spending, and theater maintenance and other things. But the bulk of that comes during this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And tourists especially account for more than 60% of Broadway tickets, so this is a big time.
All right, so with Thanksgiving and the end of the year holiday season approaching, how does the potential of a long-term strike potentially impact the big picture here, tourism-wise, financially, for New York City?
Well, anytime that a city is plagued by strikes, it begins to get a negative impression on people. Anytime a labor strike shuts down an important city service, whether it's theaters or mass transit, it damages the city's reputation in some way. I mean, people might feel that, why should I spend my money going there if I don't know that I can actually go to the places that I want to go because they might be shut down due to a strike.
Although I suspect that many people who are avoiding Paris at the moment, you know, once that strike is settled on the public transport there, will be eager to visit the City of Light. Do you think once this strike is settled, the tourists, those interested in the theater will be right back in line?
I don't know if they'll be right back, but they're likely to come back. But the short-term benefits of their visits will probably be lost because people will decide that they won't come this year and maybe they'll come next year, or else they might take a couple of years to come back instead and decide that it's not worth their time.
All right. Well, as you mentioned, Thanksgiving is fast approaching, and then, of course, the holiday season as well. Hugely important time for the theater and the ancillary industries associated with it. What do you think? Are there any prospects for a weekend solution or at least one before Thanksgiving?
I think people are hoping that this will happen because everybody on both sides of the issue want to see work start up again. It's an important part for the entire health of the industry this time of year, and I don't think anybody wants to cripple it beyond repair for the near future.
Right, we're speaking with Robert J. Hughes, staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal, about the ongoing Broadway stagehand strike. Robert, thanks very much for the update.
Thank you.
8 Broadway shows remain open, including Xanadu, Pygmalion, and Young Frankenstein. And, of course, off-Broadway productions are not covered by the same contract. But right now is not a time to have tickets to this musical, the ABBA-inspired Mamma Mia. Coming up in just a moment on Soundcheck, the author of a new book claims policymakers are neglecting the contribution of music, fashion, and the arts to New York City. And then coming up later in our show, this composer and pianist, violinist, Daniel Bernard Romain, dares to blend classical music and hip-hop. The artist known as DBR talks about a new multimedia piece about loss and isolation and plays live for us in our studio later on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and the Broadway strike may or may not impact your plans for the holiday season, but as we've just heard, it certainly affects the local economy. Broadway is, in many ways, a textbook example of how music and the arts are big business in New York. A new book called The Warhol Economy sets out to prove why the arts are so essential to the city's economy and why urban planners and policymakers should do more to encourage them. Joining us today is the book's author, Elizabeth Currid. She's an assistant professor at the University of Southern California's School of Policy, Planning, and Development. Elizabeth, welcome to Soundcheck.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, which should New Yorkers be more concerned about right now? We've got this, the recent stock market jitters on the one hand, or the Broadway strike on the other. I mean, both potentially, financially, having a big impact.
Well, I think we obviously need to be concerned about both. But I think at first blush, people are not as concerned about the Broadway strike because they think that the arts, while very aesthetically important to New York, are not necessarily quantitatively important. But if you look at the numbers, they really are.
All right. Well, you know, let me talk first about not the title of your book, but the subtitle of your book, How Fashion, Art, and Music Drive New York City. How do they drive the city when, in fact, 20% of our economy does come from the finance sector? And, you know, that's a huge slice of our pie.
Well, I think it's how you decide to look at New York's economy. So, if you look at sheer revenue, certainly Wall Street is dominating, hands down. But there's other ways to look at the economy. I mean, one is jobs. And if you look at jobs, the arts industries employ just as much as the financial industries. They're both around 5% of the total workforce. Another way that economic developers like to look at what drives an economy is a competitive advantage, which is what makes New York different from other places. And I'm not going to bore you with all the models you can run, but what does show up is that fashion, art, and music truly are what makes New York special.
So when you write, you know, about fashion, art, and music driving New York City, you don't mean it's literally driving dollars into the tills, although it does.
Right.
That the importance of culture, of the arts, is somehow different. Do you mean that virtually any city in the age of globalization can host a stock market, but only New York can offer something special that way?
Yeah, that's perfect how you put it. It really is in an age where We have this massive homogenization of places where there's a McDonald's in every place and airports look exactly the same. What makes a place ultimately unique is its cultural advantage over other places.
So what has, what accident of history has given New York that competitive edge in the arts?
Well, that's a very good question, because one of the things that economists like to argue is that places have what they call first mover advantage, is that, you know, some sort of historical fluke or some sort of innovation happens and a region or a city is able to somehow capitalize upon it. We saw that happen with Silicon Valley. We saw that happen with Hollywood film. And the same thing happened in New York with cultural industries, particularly the fashion industry. During World War II, when the Nazis occupied Paris, the media couldn't go in and pay attention to the Parisian designs. The runway shows weren't going. And so instead, they decided to focus on American designers, and many of those designers were in New York. And then you had this sort of path dependency. What I mean by that is that lots of other things sort of started happening, being set in motion, like the establishment of important institutes that supported human capital, the establishment of American Vogue, the New York Times Style Magazine. Lots of things started becoming very important and created this cluster that really cared about the fashion industry.
All right. Now I want to come back to the clustering thing in a moment. But first, it strikes me that, you know, the media could not have focused on the New York design community if there hadn't already been a New York design community. So it becomes a chicken and egg thing. Which came first, the critical mass of artists of whatever stripe here in New York, or the city that created the right environment for the artists to come in? You know what I mean?
No, that's an amazing question, and one that I think about a lot myself, because truly what makes New York fashion important to the rest of the world is the fact that there are important conduits that make it important. So the media plays an instrumental role in letting the world know, hey, we have a lot of amazing fashion designers. So you could be a great fashion designer in Kansas, but the chances that the channels to distribute it are there are quite limited.
Even in an age of globalization, when everybody has access to, you know, the internet and can potentially at least put up pictures of their designs, MP3s of their music, you know, copies of their photographs or whatever?
Well, that's the thing that's so surprising in my research, is that really, despite all of that access in technology that you would think place doesn't matter, it matters so much to the cultural industries. You really have to kind of be there. And so much of it is because a lot of their economic activities actually happen in their social environment. And the social environment are the nightclubs, are the art openings. And so you can't very well kind of pretend to be there if you're somewhere else. You really have to be in New York.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Currid. Her book is The Warhol Economy, How Fashion, Art, and Music Drive New York City. You have to be there, you say. You have to be on the scene. You give us a number of case studies in the book, and one of them is a band that we've actually heard here live in our studio in the past when they were just getting started. The band is Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah.
Oh, they're terrific.
So how are they kind of emblematic of what goes on here?
Well, really in the way that they told it to me, they were this Brooklyn indie band. And they started out playing shows in the Lower East Side, and they had their friends come. But because there was this cluster of their friends of friends would come. And, you know, just by virtue of their social network, a lot of people started going. And also by virtue of the fact that there were lots of different venues for them to play in, they had a lot of exposure. And then there were a couple of key things that happened. And that is that, you know, David Byrne and David Bowie, who are just legendary musicians, showed up at their shows. And people take notice of what David Byrne and David Bowie go to listen to. And also Pitchfork Media reviewed them. And that's actually the technology part that makes, you know, that is also part of the equation. But this confluence of different factors happening at the same time really came out of a particular place, and that's New York. They were hanging out, playing music here. They had a huge group of friends, and their friends had friends. And so, and then having these key gatekeepers and tastemakers show up. And I think that really is a function of New York as a place.
Let's hear a little bit of the music from this band called Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah.
I heard it from a friend.
song is over and over again from the band Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, who are many things, a great New York band, but also a case study in Elizabeth Currid's book, The Warhol Economy, How Fashion, Art, and Music Drive New York City. Now, I asked you about the subtitle. What about the title, The Warhol Economy? What's the reference there?
Well, Andy Warhol really captures so much of what I found was going on in New York's cultural scene. And I'd say the three really clear points I make with that title are that he, first of all, he understood the collective nature of creative industries. He understood that it wasn't just fashion and it wasn't just art and it wasn't just music. In fact, he wasn't just an artist. He was a filmmaker and he hung with the fashion set. And he understood these relationships that they're constantly engaging one another. He also was always appreciative and strove to merge commodities and art. He wanted to be a business artist. He said it himself. And so that's really something that's very popular today for artists and certainly attention too, but this relationship between commodification and culture. And finally, getting back to what we talked about earlier, was the relationship between the social environment and the way in which culture is validated. I mean, Warhol validated his social scene in the factory because he was this really cool, cutting-edge artist. But in a way, the social scene validated him, and so much got done in the factory.
Now, you alluded, in fact, you've used the term twice, the term cluster. Mm-hmm. But you're using it in a sort of economic sense of, you know, this weird phenomenon that you drive through any city, and wherever there's a Home Depot, there's a Lowe's, like right down the road. You know, you would think one would be on the east side of town and the other would be on the west, but they cluster together. And it's like that everywhere, like across the board. Why does that happen and how does that play out in the arts industry?
Well, it happens because the idea is that, you know, you can capture so much of the market demand by being somewhere. And then if another, say, Lowe's is right next to, you know, the Home Depot, then they'll capture 50% of it. And so there's always kind of trying to capture, because the assumption is that people are lazy, and so they'll just go to the one that's closest to them. But in art and culture, it actually operates differently. I think what happens in art and culture is that it reinforces itself because it's actually very efficient to be around one another. You know, the fact that you've had all of these amazing musicians come into this show, in some ways, it's because they're also here. And so there's this ease and efficiency. And everyone who's a part of that cluster is aware of it. So it's you're all playing the same game. Right. And it also reinforces itself because artists come to New York because artists come to New York. It sort of reinforces the pattern.
And is this one of the challenges facing New York City at the beginning of the 21st century, that these discrete districts are beginning to kind of disperse geographically, that they're not, you know, that all the musicians are not in a 5-block radius in Williamsburg, Brooklyn anymore, but are beginning to move around a bit?
No, that actually is one of the things that I'm most concerned with, is that New York has always had this very organic artistic community. And it's been able to, by virtue of the fact that there's been economic downturns where artists have clustered in places like the East Village. But increasingly, New York is totally cost prohibitive. And it's a place that is inaccessible to any new influx of talent. So sure, the stars of New York creative economy can live in Manhattan, but they're already established. What happens? I mean, you know, Diane von Furstenberg or Marc Jacobs, they weren't always superstars. At one point, they were young kids trying to, you know, make it happen for themselves. And now they're stars. But what happens if we run out of young kids because they just can't live here anymore? Or if they live here, they live in a far-flung part of Queens, and that density and that constant creative interaction ceases to exist.
So the clustering doesn't happen
exactly
the way it used to. Okay. We're speaking with Elizabeth Currid. The book is The Warhol Economy, How Fashion, Art, and Music Drive New York City. Now, you mentioned commodification. Andy Warhol, another reason to invoke him in the title of the book. For him, commodification and culture were somewhere along the same spectrum. They were not like polar opposites. And there is another case study in your book, and that is Jay-Z and this weird brand of sneakers. Tell us that story.
Oh, the Bathing Apes?
Yeah.
Well, you know,
Bathing Apes.
Jay-Z, as an extremely talented musician, also becomes a very important gatekeeper, because by virtue of the fact that he has established a symbolic cultural cachet as a rap star, he also has established a certain kind of credibility to pass judgment on other kinds of cultural forms. And so people care and they take cues from Jay-Z. Jay-Z is, you know, not initially known as a fashion designer, though he is now one, but what he wears, people care about. And so immediately, if he's wearing a sneaker, like the sneaker I talk about in the book, he's wearing Bathing Apes, they're sort of obscure for 1 minute. And then everyone who cares about Jay-Z says, what are those cool shoes he's wearing? And then suddenly everyone wants a pair of them.
And then suddenly the price is $400
yes.
a pair. All right, Jay-Z, show me what you got. It's some music from Jay-Z. We're talking about the Warhol economy with author Elizabeth Currid.
Let's go get them, Chuck. Hey, 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 show me what you got, little mama. Show me what you got, bird lady. Show me what you got, shawty. Show me what you got, baby. Hands up and wave, 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 and wave. Get a drum or some. I already gave the summer some. It's the winter's turn. Hobie ho is the coldest. I just get better with time. I'm like Opus. One, young, no to it like a snowflake. Okay, show me what you got, babe. Words are slurring, engine purring. Mommy front, but I'm so determined. Shots up a drone, now she in the zone. I ain't talking about the 2-3. Mommy in the zone like the homie 2-3. Jordan a chain, make no difference. You all ballin' the same. I am the Mike Jordan of recording. You might wanna fall back from recording. But you're right, it's not important, so I forced him to go for the hype. For being brave, they may applaud him. But misery, I will assure them.
That is Jay-Z and Show Me What You Got. And boy, he's gone well beyond being a rapper to being a CEO and being a fashionista as well, as Elizabeth Currid recounts in her book, The Warhol Economy, How Fashion, Art, and Music Drive New York City. And we'd like to hear from you, our Soundcheck listeners. How important is it to be in New York City if you're an artist? Could you, in fact, produce your art anywhere else? You can leave a comment on the Soundcheck page of our website at WNYC.org. And if you're outside of New York City, give us your perspective on the issue. The Soundcheck page, WNYC.org. Elizabeth Currid is not only the author of The Warhol Economy, but Elizabeth, you also are an assistant professor at USC's School of Policy, Planning, and Development. So give us some policy and planning recommendations for how New York deals with stratospheric real estate prices and all the other things that we've been talking about as challenges for the future.
Well, I think that there's two ways that policymakers could start thinking about how to cultivate the arts and support them. The one is that if you want to support art, you might want to support the artists themselves. So a lot of policy does support the institutions that are important to artists. But, you know, really when it comes down to it, we're talking about people who are producing the creativity that drives New York. And so whether it's subsidizing rents or subsidizing the neighborhoods or you know, protecting neighborhoods from becoming gentrified, I think it needs to happen more on the street level.
So you're not saying the government should give stipends to artists. You're saying do some kind of rent control special
yes.
thing for certain neighborhoods where artists have tended to congregate.
Yeah. If the most
preserve those clusters.
Exactly.
That you, okay.
Exactly. And the other thing that I think is counterintuitive to people who make policy is to almost be anti-gentrifiers. And so what I mean by that is that we all know that where artists cluster, they tend to revitalize a neighborhood. And what comes next is the bankers come in and the lawyers come in, and then the artists have to move out because the rent prices go up. And suddenly all the reasons that these bankers wanted to come in cease to exist because the creative people don't live there anymore. So it's just a lot of really wealthy people. And so
with those artists' photographs and paintings hanging on their wall.
Right, exactly. It's sort of a virtual artistic community, but it's not actually.
But don't the artists need those? I mean, those people need a place to live too. And the artists need them to sort of, you know, buy tickets to the shows and concerts and stuff.
Absolutely. So the point is that it's not that you just say, well, no one who makes above, you know, I don't know, $50,000 or whatever it is can live in this community. It's that you are just protective of the integrity of the community. And that just might mean protecting those that are in there while letting growth come in.
Has this ever been done? Are there any case examples of this working anywhere else?
I don't think so. I'm not an expert on lots of different places. I'm an expert on New York. But as far as I've seen in my research, I have not come across places that have implemented something like this.
You know, it's funny because in London, especially in the City of London, mm-hmm. you know, their financial area,
yes.
the corporation of the City of London, which maintains the area there, the square mile as it's known, is the second largest arts contributor in the UK after the BBC. It's a government that's basically supporting the indigenous artists there in the financial center of London. So, but on the other hand, you have the example of the New Jersey Performing Arts Center right across the river. Opened in 1997, planners hoped that it would spark a downtown revival in Newark, and that hasn't really happened. So what does that say about being able to impose art from above as opposed to letting it kind of grow up?
Well, this is the ultimate problem in a lot of economic development, is that you sort of have this mentality of if you build it, they will come. And that doesn't work. You really need to create environments or support environments that actually cultivate the kinds of social dynamics that make art happen. And so that is density, that is lower rent, that is space to work. Planting a museum somewhere is not going to do the trick.
Mm-hmm. It's a somewhat odd way to end the segment, but let's take a phone call from Jack Lewis calling
yes.
us from Oregon. Jack, I understand you used to live here in New
yes.
York.
Yes, I grew up on the Lower East Side, and I was an artist and musician, and I'm still an artist and musician, but I got priced out, and I moved to Portland, Oregon, and I see a lot of my friends struggling in New York, trying to make their art, trying to work a job, and it just definitely takes away from the creativity, the landlords and the high rent prices.
Are you able to find a community, a cluster, as it were, there in Oregon?
I'm looking. I've been here for a year. There's definitely a huge music community. There's
yeah.
less of a artistic community. There's less museums here. I worked at a museum in New York also, and it's also pretty difficult for artists to see free art and experience that as well. There's one free day a week, you know.
All right. Well, there's a case study for you. Jack, thanks very much for calling in. Elizabeth, it comes down to having a critical mass at some point of artists and of interest. I mean, it can't just be a completely insular ivory tower kind of thing.
Absolutely.
So anything that other cities can learn from New York as we wrap up here? Is there one thing that other places can take away from this book, The Warhol Economy?
Absolutely. I think the thing that's most important is that other cities pay attention to what's going on where they are. Don't try to emulate New York. Look at your own strengths and talents and get on the street and find out how art works in your own city.
The book is The Warhol Economy, How Fashion, Art, and Music Drive New York City. Elizabeth Currid is the author. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on the program, a live performance from a composer and violinist with an omnivorous musical appetite, Daniel Bernard Romain, or DBR as he's known. And coming up on tomorrow's Soundcheck, a Swiss orchestra recently took on the name of a financial giant. We'll look at the role of corporate sponsorship in the classical music world. This is Soundcheck.